Hi everyone, this is Marsha, and I'm the director and founder of the Brooklyn Caribbean Literary Festival. I'm thrilled and elated to announce the birth and launch of our brand new podcast, CocoaPod. Consider the aromatic CocoaPod and how, after carefully ripening under the Caribbean sun, it generously offers up its rich fruit in due season. CocoaPod by BCLF aims to provide a similar delight. Each episode is a seed, a nugget of an original Caribbean story told in the voice of its writer. Each story, an infinite gift by the offshoot of an ancient griot tradition. As a whole, Caribbean stories are like a mighty tree whose branches extend, offering shade and comfort wherever her children settle. The BCLF CocoaPod will burst open with the finalist and winning stories of the 2021 BCLF Short Fiction Story Contest. From my team and the legion of Caribbean writers behind us, we bring to you the warmest of welcomes. The very first stories to come out of this pod are from this year's short story winners and finalists. You'll laugh as two friends mark time and the milestones of their lives as they drink their way across the top shelf of a neighborhood's bar in Rumshelf, confront grief, mourning, and family secrets in distinctly different ways in The Wailers and Bitter Tea, two stories whose reflections on death are as far north and south as the writers' islands themselves. You'll root for a plucky, talented singer who on the day of a very special performance takes matters into her own hands in singing with the orphans. And finally, you'll experience the reunion of a daughter and her wildly famous, estranged father who's losing his memory in Daughter 4.
I am Patrice Grell-Yersic, winner of the 2021 BCLF Elizabeth Nunez Caribbean American Writers Prize for my short story, Daughter 4. I am a Trinidadian-born writer who currently lives in downtown Chicago. My writing efforts began in high school in Trinidad, where I wrote poems under a pseudonym for weekend editions of the Trinidad Guardian. I then went on to attend the University of Miami, where I earned undergraduate degrees in film script writing and creative writing. And I went on to complete the MFA in creative writing fiction, as well as a teaching assistantship that led me to create classes and coursework for creative writing students. Post-graduation, I became the calendar editor at the Miami New Times newspaper. And in 2006, I created Afrobella.com to celebrate women all shades of beautiful. I have been featured in Essence, Ebony, Glamour, Trinidad Guardian, Women's Wear Daily, and Fast Company. I have covered red carpets at the BET Awards, New York Fashion Week, and the Academy Awards, amongst others. In addition to my work with Afrobella.com, I offer robust and informed copywriting services to brands in the beauty, hair, fashion, and food industries, and I regularly contribute writing to a variety of notable publications, including Better Homes and Gardens, Reader's Digest, Food and Wine, TripAdvisor, Travel and Leisure, and Zora. Currently, I am working on a collection of short stories inspired by life in Trinidad and Tobago. Daughter 4 by Patrice Grell-Yersic. T-Marie was half asleep when she heard Sheena bawl out, "Your phone ringing!" She jumped out of bed just as Sheena headed out the front door, facing the day before 8 a.m. The scent of Irish spring hung in her wake. "Oh, go on, so you wake me and gone," T-Marie groused, shrugging on a leopard print bathrobe. Sheena made a loud kissing sound in response and grinned, a gold tooth glinting in the sunlight. "You should be up, Lisa's," she said with a wink. Sheena slid behind the wheel of her Datsun 280C and drove out to the taxi stand. This whole time, T-Marie phone vibrating all over the desk next to the sewing machine, TT Police on a caller ID. Concern furrowed her brow. She cleared her throat and answered, "Hello? Good morning. Who am I speaking to?" the caller asked, his voice a deep baritone. "You call me and you want to know who you call?" T-Marie responded. Before coffee, she had no patience for dotishness. Miss Bailey, your last name Bailey? The man asked. Yes, who is this? T. Marie replied. This is Officer Cropper at the Gadsden Street Station. Your father is in custody. Please come and pick him up, he said. T. Marie sat down heavily. My father? Yes, Miss Bailey. Ask for me when you arrive. Officer Cropper. He hung up the phone. T. Marie realized she never replied, yes, no, dog, cats are coming, nothing. My father in custody. And is me they call? Why? She forget all who come in to pick up dresses. Instead, she hurried to make herself presentable for the police station. T. Marie was in a haze of memories the whole drive from Carinage to downtown. Her father was Frederick Bailey, the legendary steel pan arranger known throughout the archipelago as a genius and a scoundrel with women in every port and a child anywhere there was an annual Caribbean festival. Her mother was Leslie Ann, the voluptuous dark-skinned girl from the gingerbread house on the corner, who joined the damn steel band just to be in his orbit. The big joke was that Fred Bailey could beat a pan and make a pussy. He was tall, with a barrel chest, and a reputation for outsized appetites. T. Marie had her father's build and gap-toothed smile. When she was little, Fred used her as a mascot for the band. They wore matching costumes on his album cover, Goat Don't Make Sheep. By the time she was 7, Fred stopped showing up to the birthday parties. 1988, he brought a Christmas gift on Boxing Day, and her mother told him about himself by the front gate. After that, his visits ceased completely. The last time she saw him was at her mother's funeral. He held court at the back of the church, but never made it to the cemetery. And now here she was, parked by the police station, wondering why she showed up for this man who hadn't shown up for her in years. She smoothed her linen skirt, crossed the street, and trotted up the crumbling concrete stairs. T. Marie approached the gloomy-faced policeman at the front desk. Hello, Officer Cropper called me. What is your name, ma'am? He asked. Lynette Bailey, but they call me T. Marie. I was a little shy girl growing up. She smiled as she explained the nickname her father had given her. She hid behind her mother so much he dubbed her T. Marie, the plant known as shameweed, whose leaves close at the slightest touch. As she spoke, she wondered why she was telling this policeman her business. The dour policeman showed her to Officer Cropper's corner behind tall metal cabinets. He was a big-bellied desk cop whose days of running down a bandit were long behind him. Thanks for coming on such short notice, he said by way of greeting. Your father has been in custody for 4 days. Last week, he showed up at Jumbie Studios and tried to cuff down a gentleman. He shot somebody's car, and by this time, T. Marie had her head in her hands. Apparently, he thought somebody owed him money for a musical composition. Turns out he was looking for the man's father, who passed away years ago. The guy won't press charges, he said. His mind comes and goes. Yesterday, he talked to me good, and today he forget where he is. How did you find me? T. Marie asked. We went through his phone, Officer Cropper replied. I didn't know he had my number, T. Marie muttered. Any other Trini man lock up, and there they would have stayed until they could make bail. But Fred Bailey have a Chaconia award, so he gets a bly. Where's the drop him? I hear he renting down in Salibia, she said. Sangre Grande. The landlord already called the locksmith. He was given trouble there too. They found bullet holes in his wall, Officer Cropper said with a chuckle. What am I supposed to do, take him by me? T. Marie asked, an incredulous note in her tone. Yes, ma'am. If you can't, there's a government facility, but Officer Cropper shook his head. I wouldn't put your father there. What about a home for the elderly? They have one by the church around the Savannah, she suggested. He shook his head again, stood and stretched. That is a paid facility, ma'am. Being with family will help him. Mikey, he called out to a young officer. Tell Mr. Bailey his daughter, Lynette T. Marie Bailey, is here. He said, beaming like he was proud of himself. Same time, he pointed at a pile of items. These are his things. We'll carry them out for you. A leather wallet, a cell phone, a garbage bag of clothes, a big cardboard box. Besides that, a large steel pan case emblazoned with the Trinidad and Tobago flag. He also had a loaded 45 in his possession. We took custody of that, Officer Cropper added. T. Marie nodded gratefully. The front desk officer returned with a shuffling, disheveled old man. Faded steel pan t-shirt, khaki shorts, rubber slippers, white afro sticking up higgledy-piggledy, no gold chains, no barrel chest, none of the Fred Bailey trademarks. Just those round eyes and the gap tooth were the same. T. Marie reached out. When her father hugged her, nothing about him was familiar. Not his scent, his lean body, the hot tears pressed into her neck during his embrace, nothing. He clung to her like he hadn't since she was a child. Big, hard, back 30-something, T. Marie felt her eyes prickle in response and realized this cry she about to cry right there in the police station. Quickly, she thanked Officer Cropper. Then the younger cop picked up her father's belongings and followed them out. Fred winced as the cop carelessly dumped his steel pan case into T. Marie's trunk. Miss Bailey, you are in trust of a national treasure, Officer Cropper declared. Mr. Bailey, don't give your daughter trouble, he chuckled. It was an honor to meet you, sir. God bless. He shook Fred's hand and patted the hood of the car before walking away. For the first time since childhood, T. Marie was alone with her father. They drove in silence, zigzagging through neighborhoods to avoid traffic. After a time, Fred cleared his throat. Your mother was a great flag woman, he mumbled. And T. Marie shook her head. She wasn't no flag woman, she replied. My mother was Leslie Ann. She played in your band the first year all you won Panorama. After Scrunta writes about Annie Lopez, many others wanted to be a woman on the bass too, he chuckled. And for a moment, he sounded like the musical expert whose voice she would have heard on the radio in Mommy's car before she changed the station. She had loved that tune, but she used to beat a tenor pan, T. Marie said. Ah, yes, lovely Leslie Ann from the gingerbread house on the corner. How's she going? She died 6 years ago. Ovarian cancer. The funeral is at St. Teresa's. You don't remember? I don't. I kind of fed up of everybody asking what I remember, he said. He scowled like a petulant child. T. Marie sucked her teeth loud and hard. I supposed to feel sorry for you because you old? You just tell me who Scrunta writes a tune for, but you don't remember my mother. She never mattered to you. After a timing, he muttered, sorry. T. Marie didn't say boo for the rest of the drive. Around the corner, they caught a glimpse of the sea crashing on rocks, and Fred looked confused. Where you carry me? I live in Sangre Grande, and you shoot up the place and they don't want you back. I have your things in the trunk, remember? He looked at her blankly. T. Marie sighed. You're staying with me for now. We're in Carinage, she said. They pulled up to her beaten concrete home. He let himself out as she opened her trunk to retrieve his things. You're real lucky, you know. She set him at the table and got him a glass of water. He guzzled it like he hadn't drank in days. She filled a pitcher with ice water and placed it before him. T. Marie heated up some pillow from the leftovers in the fridge, and Fred shoveled it into his mouth so quickly she worried he would choke. You have pepper sauce? He asked, his mouth bulging. Is that Trini house you in? She replied, fetching homemade scotch bonnet sauce from the fridge. When he finished, he belched hard, closed his eyes, and leaned back in his chair. Thanks, eh? No problem, T. Marie said, clearing his plate. She felt like she was playing waitress. After the meal, Fred wanted to lie down. There were two choices, the futon in her sewing room or the bed that she shared with Sheena, and T. Marie wasn't giving that up. The futon was covered with half-finished garments for clients whose calls she had ignored all day. Let me clear up, she sighed. She piled bolts of cloth in a corner, hung clothing over the back of her chair, pushed the futon flat and dusted off a rainbow of thread snippets. She returned to find Fred sitting at the table, half asleep, snores coming from the back of his throat. Fred, he didn't wake. She touched his shoulder. Fred Bailey. Finally, he stirred. Confusion in his eyes gave way to recognition. A fix up for you. She guided him to her sewing room. Timari realized his clothes were stained with pepper sauce from lunch. She found a t-shirt, shorts, and a bottle of Limacol amongst his belongings and set them on the futon. "Do me a favor," he asked beseechingly. "What you need?" "You could set up my steel pan if you see how rough the policeman have it in the trunk," he said. Like he forget it's her trunk he was talking about. Timari moved the fan closer to the bed. She set up the metal stand, gently placing the gleaming instruments on top. When she turned around, Fred was lying down, his eyes closed. She tiptoed out and shut the door. Timari got weed and papers from Sheena's drawer and a cold carob from the fridge, then headed to the front porch to twist a spliff. She sparked it while scrolling through the names in her father's phone. Ansel, Baseman, Braffy, Carlton, Daphne, daughter one, daughter two, daughter three, and then her number, daughter four. Timari snorted in disbelief. "I am daughter four. So what about daughters one, two, and three?" she wondered as she scrolled, smoked, sipped. Darkness had just fallen when she saw headlights. Sheena stepped out of her taxi and kissed Timari, tasting smoke and lager on her lips. "Like you start happy hour without me," Sheena teased, smiling. "I needed to." "I have a story for you," Timari said. Just so, pan music started drifting out the window. The whisper of a melody becoming louder, more confident. "Woman on the bass," he started to play.
Let's go back to what we were saying about you experiencing this process from the other side.
It, you know, for some reason it has triggered anxiety in me. And I think so much of it is because I'm sharing a new part of myself with the world, I guess, which try not to think of it that way. But it's something that's so close to your heart. And it's something that is so that you know will be viewed by the community in which you were raised, or that speaks about the community in which you were raised. Mm-hmm. And there's something about that that just makes me but you know, there's also a unique pride to it, and it feels more special than I've had a lot of accomplishment. I've been blessed to have a lot of accomplishment in my career, and this feels more special and therefore more anxiety inducing than and many other things.
Yeah. I feel like as people coming from very small islands, we're always looking for someone to put us on the map, right? And I don't know if any of your angst or your anxiety has had to do with how your people are represented, like how you represent your people without being treacherous, but also with being very honest, right?
Yes, exactly. It's a balance, you know what I mean? And I know it's something that you and I have discussed in the past, where you might read something in a book or read something in an article and not recognize the representation of self that you would hope it would be, or wanting maybe more rose-colored lens or less rose-colored lens. It depends on what the piece might be. And this is just trying to write an honest, relatable, real car. These, to me, these are characters that started waking me up at night because I knew them so well. Like, time to tell my story, you know? So it is something that, that I hope resonates in a respectful and loving, but unmistakably genuine way.
As a reader, I'm constantly searching for anachronisms. I feel like when somebody doesn't get something right, like if you're writing about Victorian England and you use a phrase or term that was not part of that culture, not part of the lexicon landscape at the time, I'm quick to shoot you down for credibility.
Right.
One of the things, and you, because we have a lot of history and we know each other for a long time, and what people don't know, or they will probably come to realize as you embark on this fiction journey, is that you are a natural born storyteller, right? And there's like the best part of you telling a story is looking at you tell the story, because you use your whole Right, like,
I was like, oh, I get to act with my face now for the only first
time. Yeah, so I feel like when we were in school, you know, people talk about my face doesn't have an inside voice, like your face is always giving away what you feel. But one of the things that we loved about Daughter 4, and I'm just kind of reminding everyone that it was a blind judging process, especially based on the guidelines that were submitted when we asked for these stories. To see Faisal and Barbara emerge and tell us these are our top stories and that one was yours, man. And then to read the story and be like, somebody is getting it right. Back to my always kind of looking for anachronisms. I want to get it right. Being a Trinidadian myself, born and raised, and I feel like I have a better understanding of my culture than most people. Mm-hmm. And with the BCLF, I'm kind of standing in guardianship of not only Trinidadian culture, but Caribbean culture. Yes. You executed that story in a way that was so authentic, right? Like the policeman, the observations that you made, the singer sewing machine. I think that your storytelling style heralds a new wave of storytellers. And I'm seeing it in more and more stories as they emerge from our region. There's no caricatures. Like, we're telling stories of real people. Like, we are real people. This is a real place. We live where you vacation, but it's where we live, right?
Exactly.
And just with an honesty and a rawness. And with all of the societal ills that we've been bequeathed, right? Like, where we are has everything to do with where we came from. So fractured family relationships, you know, men who take on these personas, right? And we can look back into slavery and see all the reasons why those were caused. But those things are prevalent in Daughter 4, right?
There's the shadows that linger.
Snuck in alternative lifestyles, right?
Right,
you snuck that in, and it wasn't central to the story, but you also gave them visibility too, right?
That's part of who they just are, and that's been part of the story that I want to tell. The stories that I want to tell that are in me that are coming out now are just not to reduce it to the name of a calypso, but a portrait of Trinidad. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm just trying to give, a portrait of real people. Mm-hmm. Real life that takes place in a particular geographic, you know, location, mm-hmm. but is universally relatable in a lot of ways, but at the same time is us, is we. Mm-hmm. And it's been very interesting going through the process of writing it and sharing it. Before I actually finished the story, well, this story started out as like 1,000 plus words.
How did you, I mean, that's like a special skill, contracting this into 2,000 words. So go ahead, so you start with 4,000 plus.
Yes, and now I read it and I'm like, ah, oh, there's so much I want to put back in, you know what I mean? Like, to give them more. Yeah. And I will, you know, at some point. But that in itself, I feel like I'm getting ahead of myself. This has been such an honor. And I have to say, the blind judging piece of it is what makes it so important for me, because mm-hmm. I'm literally presenting something to people that are part of my landscape and mm-hmm. part of my upbringing. So knowing that it has been received the way that it has been received blind, you know, like, it just feels really, it feels so special. It feels so good. And that is, it's just everything.
When I read it, I felt like I found, you know, our birth certificates before the computerized ones.
Yeah.
Right? Like, flawed a little bit because somebody hand wrote it, but there was just so much character. Like, that's what I feel like. If I had to give a visual representation of what, or a visual equivalent of what the story is, it would be like one of those old birth certificates, the original birth certificates that every Trinidadian, every person who was born in Trinidad and Tobago owned. It's a
phenomenon. I'm so glad this is being recorded because I'm going to watch this again when I can. right now, I'm just letting your words wash over me. It means so much.
Yeah, there's it means everything. And you're a celebrity. This is on podcast, so nobody's gonna see us and they're gonna hear us, right?
Okay.
Like, you're a little celebrity in your own right. You have knocked down so many doors. You have like barged your way in into industries where maybe you were told you didn't belong or there was no place for you. And I think in a lot of ways with blogging, somebody said to me, there was something they said about blogging, but it really reduced the blogger. It reduced the credibility of the blogger and that person's qualifications. But you did something entirely new for the blogosphere. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my goal when I launched Afrobello was, it was before blogging was seen as a career. It was before it could be a career. I can say my peers and I in that era, this is 2006 when I started this. There was no lane. We made our own lane. We are pioneers. And it's something that it took me years to accept and to step into. Mm-hmm. But truly, I found myself in a career path that did not exist when I was in school, mm-hmm. that did not exist when I was in college even. It wasn't something I could have foreseen. And going into these new places was scary sometimes. And also coming into something that you are completely writing your passion. Like I said, there was no previous. So I can't say I'm coming into this with a fashion background or a beauty background or any kind of, you know, but I tell stories. I've always told stories and I've always loved telling other people's stories, and that is part of, and part of it was telling my own and learning to tell my own and figuring out what it was. But a lot of it was also the things that inspired me, and the it became even the brands and who is behind the brand and what is it. And it then became telling the story of an industry that I got to watch grow around me, because the natural hair landscape was not what it is at all back then.
Yeah.
So there's so many ways that I can look back and say.
But you're a little bit of an architect, for right? Like,
I can say I had a hand in this, or I had a hand in that, or I knew this before it became what it is. And it is crazy. It is crazy. Like, I will go to Target, for example, or any retail store, and I'm like, I remember when she was making that in her kitchen. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, there's so many brands that I know of that I've seen them grow. And I know in my heart that I was part of that process, and watching the entrepreneurial wave of everything that came from the Black beauty and going back to this natural hair movement that we created. It's been amazing. It's been amazing. And I'm still here.
It feels a lot like storytelling, telling of the story might be the constant thread through all of your passions.
I think so. I really think so. And that's something that I was talking to my dad about the other day, you know, because we talk a lot. My dad is somewhat of a Calypso historian. And so much of that, I think, gave me the foundation that I have. Yeah. Because obviously I was born and raised in Trinidad. I left when I was 19. I have been living in America half my life, which is a crazy thing to say.
Crazy thing to think about.
It is definitely like, wow, okay. Like, when I look at my age, my big age, and the year that I left, I'm like, I really, a lot of my foundational growing up experiences were there, but then ended and then began anew in a different place. And how do you stay rooted in your culture when you have left? And so much of that has to do with your upbringing, mm-hmm. and the seeds that were planted and the interests that were planted. So with my dad being so into Calypso, you know, we were talking about this the other day, when Winston Devine passed, Mm-hmm. We were talking about the work that somebody like him did of mm-hmm. telling stories, mm-hmm. of letting other people tell their stories through his pen. That is, in a way, what I aspire to do. And I think in some ways have done, I hope,
yeah.
and continue to do. So
yeah.
I think it's important. And also just the, in some ways, I think Afrobella has begun to chafe a little bit because it felt so self-reflective. Mm-hmm. And the nature of this game, when I first started it, it was a blog, right? And it was a blog for a long time, and it still is a blog. But then it became being a social media persona, influencer, these new terms that didn't exist in the beginning. And that is where it started to feel a little like, I don't know if I want to do this fully,
yeah.
you know? And I still love telling other people's stories so much more. And it feels more fulfilling. So, yeah.
We constantly interrogate Caribbean American identities. It took me a long time to accept that hyphen, right? Like I would say to people, I'm a Trinidad, and I just happen to be living here.
Exactly.
But I recognize that there's a very important work that we are doing, right? Like as we evolve, we are creating space and validation for our children, for people who are looking on at us. We end up being role models, whether we like it or not. With your work, you have opened the door of possibilities, if not just the doors of creative imaginations for lots of, you know, men, women, girls, boys, and however, you know, and the spectrum of identities. What do you see? And writing fiction now, from what I'm hearing, is kind of like is it the chickens come home to roost? Right? Because you're coming back to your fiction. You're coming
Absolutely.
Back to your original writing background. Where do you see your trajectory? Like, if you had to plot this, if you had to write your own story from here on out, where would it go?
My goal is, I mean, I have immediate projects and I have a future vision. And the immediate projects involve a short story collection, two novels that mm-hmm. I already have. I see them so clearly in my mind, Marsha. Like mm-hmm. I see them. A short story collection, a cookbook. Like these are things that I already am like, I know mm-hmm. that I can move forward on doing.
Mm-hmm.
So in my next couple of years, I have projects that I fully envision of execution.
Mm-hmm.
But then in the work that I keep doing, I keep encountering other authors and other people who I know have books in them too. So I really would love to be able to be a Caribbean author like Elizabeth Nunez,
mm-hmm.
who has been able to open doors for other Caribbean authors in America.
Mm-hmm.
We are from a place that has such a rich literary history. And such a rich creative capability
mm-hmm.
beyond even writing literary fiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wrote a story for Food and Wine this year about Sylvia Hunt.
You know, I was all over that story.
I know. I know. And the process of it taught me so much. And the outcome of it has been also an education in itself because it has shown me some of the struggles of getting a book published in the Caribbean as a Caribbean author.
Mm-hmm.
And the obstacle course that exists, I would love to remove.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that I aspire to in my future. I watched a documentary about Toni Morrison, and I don't know if you've seen it.
You're the second person who told me about it, though. Like, I have to watch this documentary, right?
I like when in my future home where I have an office, I just want it playing all the time on a screen. That's how I felt about it. Like this thing was so powerful. This thing was so powerful. And to see all of the different chapters of her life that she is still the author that everybody aspires to become, however she paved a path for others to publish and created a community of authors and worked within the system of publishing to bring others to fruition. That's something that I cannot stop thinking about these days and how important and how necessary it is, because there are people who want to put out books in our islands that are stumbling into financial hardships that make it impossible to do so based on the structure that exists within our publishing systems. Mm-hmm. How do we get past that? And how do we make sure that our books are still going to get read at home? Mm-hmm. Because it's one thing to go to England and get a book deal and get seen. It's another thing to come to America and be seen by the agents that be, powers that be here, and get your book in Random House or whatever.
Absolutely.
But I want my book in Campus Corner.
Yeah.
And I want my book in the airport.
And I want my book that's in Campus Corner and in the airport to have the same gloss and luster and quality of the books that are on the shelves here.
Exactly. Right? And
that speaks to resources, access to resources, and the resources that exist.
And to know that the books, it breaks my heart when I see a book that was published in Trinidad or published in Barbados or published wherever, when I see and I feel the cover and the quality of the paper and binding, that they deserve better, that sometimes they spend their own money to put out, and the labor of love that it is to put out a book under those circumstances, I have a whole new understanding of it. And I want to remove that as much as I can in my future. So this is Patrice at age 50.
Oh my God, that is necessary, all writers, I'm not going to say they're in dire straits, but the industry requires that kind of handling and that kind of intervention. I think that's why we're here. In a lot of ways, the BCLF kind of aligns with the same with the same mission. Which of the characters in Daughter 4 woke you up first? Because you're like, these people were waking you up at night.
Hey, Marie.
For real?
She was waking me up.
Yeah.
Her in particular. Yeah. And she needed... she needed to figure out her story. She was getting stressed out. Fred was stressing her out. It's really remarkable how, and this is not the only character, only story that I've written that this has been happening to. I have other pieces that are in the works and a whole collection that's in the works that I will talk to you about whenever you want. Mm-hmm. But that started happening for real. And I would wake up at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, knowing that I have a full day of obligations for other people and other publications ahead of me, but unable to go to sleep until I had written out paragraph, couple sentences of what these people were telling me in my sleep. So it has been quite a journey, and it feels very cathartic.
All writers say that these stories come to them. Shari Jones has a wonderful story of how her characters came to her for how the one arm sister sweeps her house. She was on a bus in England. Mm. She had a long journey, a long commute. And she was on the bus one night and these stories came to her.
It is something in the creative process that I had not encountered. Because, you know, you were discussing earlier that I've come back to fiction. So I did a whole MFA. I have a short story collection that I had written as part of that process. It's called Tabanka Trinidadian Lovesickness. So that is already a book that I had just sitting down here. I had entered a short story.
Who has not had a Tabanka, boy? Who has not lived? You've not lived unless you had a Tabanka.
I don't think that you could really be an adult Trini and say that you haven't had some form of it, right? You know, some stage or some form, whether it's for a person or for the land itself or for, you know, a career or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, we have all had our Tabankas. but so I have kind of gone through this process. And then in some ways, I felt like the fiction that I was working on back in, 2003, you know, it just wasn't, the world wasn't ready for it and I wasn't ready to write it.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to really question if these were stories that would be received And I started to then feel like there was this larger publishing industry that wasn't really giving Caribbean people their flowers or ready to tell our stories and give our stories the celebration they deserve and the recognition they deserve. And I think in a lot of ways, I needed to take some time to read more, to learn more, to experience more. And now that's why it started to bubble up inside me. Maybe the pandemic had something to do with it too. I don't know. Time to sit still and time to almost cloister inside yourself and find things that you thought were long buried. I know I'm not the only one who went through that, but in the last 2 years.
Yeah.
It just came out differently.
Yeah. And accepting that becoming might be uncomfortable and a difficult process, but I think it becomes like breath, like it becomes like life. If I don't get this out of me, it's going to suffocate me or I'm going to die.
Yeah, exactly. Or these characters will suffocate and die. And I just can't let that happen. You know, like I can't let that happen because they're real to me. You know what I mean? So
is there anything in those old stories that's worth revisiting?
Yes. And I'm doing that. There's a whole off camera story I'm going to tell you later. One of those stories has really come back into focus in a way that I cannot believe. So it's new life, old life coming back together and being able to like take that. I'm taking that old photo off the shelf or that old record off the shelf and the dust is blowing off of it.
Yes.
And what is it going to be now? You know what I mean? When you polish it up and you share it again, going through that process has been interesting.
So the last line of the judge's comments read, "We were astonished by the subtleties and the restraint of the storytelling, as well as its emotional cadences." And for real, there were things that could have made the character just want to bawl, right? And you conveyed that, and I feel like as you were writing, and she was restraining herself from this emotional experience, you conveyed that with your pen. And I wish you the best. I hope this is not the last. As a matter of fact, this is not the last you'll be hearing from us. Like, there's no way this is the last you're going to be hearing from me and the BTLF anyways. And we want first dibs on, like, just about everything you're doing.
Thank you. Absolutely. I the support that you have given and the support that I feel from the BCLF community is it means so much beyond words. I don't even have it. Even from last year's winner, connecting with Stephanie has been, you know what I mean? And just connecting with this year's winner in Trinidad as well. Like it becomes like, I feel I'm ushered into a community of writers that I've always wanted to be part of.
Yeah.
And it just feels like that stamp of legitimacy, like, okay, now I can call myself this and step into this chapter of my life. So I just can't even say thank you enough.
You're welcome. We're like the women in Marlon James, the Book of Night Women, who meet in that cave, that little coven.
Exactly.
Like, that's who we are.
We hope that you enjoyed this episode. Please take a moment to follow CocoaPod and turn on your notifications so that you don't miss new stories when they drop. One last thing. Caribbean stories and Caribbean writers need our help. Show your support by sharing and downloading this podcast as far and as widely as you can. Buy their books, support independent bookshops, and request Caribbean titles from your local libraries. Remember that a rising tide lifts all ships. Give thanks. For more Caribbean storytelling goodness, follow CocoaPod and BCLF Always Lit on all major podcast platforms.